want a chance to just explain what we mean by that. And let me just set the stage. The explicit framework for the community benefits plan was to take the lessons learned of the community benefits agreement and improve the outcomes. That was the explicit goal of that process. No change in the 1% set aside. No change in accountability, except the city did something which we're often accused of not doing enough, which is the city said, we're going to be accountable for reaching the goals ultimately. And then we did something that I thought was noteworthy, and it was certainly noteworthy when we unanimously embraced the community benefits plan, which was the successor to the community benefits agreement. We set higher goals for MWESB participation across the board. We set a more ambitious framework for equity and opportunity in this project. And we said that at the end of the day, we're so committed to this, we're going to make the city accountable, not some committee. And we didn't disband any committee. We have an advisory committee made up of, we hope, the same thoughtful and knowledgeable people. But the city said, we're lifting the bar, and we are going to be accountable for reaching those goals. I have to say, that's an entirely different impression when I recite the facts than I get from listening to this presentation. And so I have to ask, what is really dividing us? So I've had meetings with friends here and friends in the audience. And we've had very frank conversations, as we often do. And what I have been told that the central flaw of our approach going forward is that my friends in labor are not signatories to the CBP. You can nod your head, but that is, in most of my meetings, has been what I have been told is the central flaw of this approach. And I welcome your view on that, but that has been framed as the central flaw.
Let me just correct that, please, Commissioner.
I hope you correct more than that. Because
I'd like to start with that. First of all, it's not a question of focusing on labor signatories. It's community partners being signatory to a CBA agreement or to some other kind of agreement in which you actually have oversight on a monthly basis in real time, as opposed to an advisory committee that's so rarely convening that it's not in real time. And keeping in mind that the CBP was designed for much smaller dollar amount contracts.
Okay. So, fair enough. And so a document that has signatories, whether it's an MOU, whether it's the CBP, whatever you want to call it, is a central stumbling point that has been expressed to me. No change in the set-aside, the money. Higher goals for the project, with the city accepting full responsibility for reaching those goals. I just want to make sure I understand, because I'm missing something.
Right, and so maybe
how
I can...
How does that, an experience under the CBA that both the ECPC and you have said we should celebrate. So my question is, if we have said we're going to raise the bar, how did we throw the baby out with the bathwater? What am I missing?
So what I would say is two things. First, I think you're missing one of the greatest points of the CBA is that it's a collective responsibility. No offense, but the city has been found wanting when you tried to do it yourselves. Clearly, it takes, you know, CBOs who can recruit people of color and folks in poverty and then train them and then to partner with signatory or union-based trainers, which represents 70% of the training organizations for apprenticeship in our region. It's like the idea of saying, hey, PCC and Mount Hood Community College, we're going to offer free community college, but not through you. So this idea that, A, the city can do this by itself because it has such a great track record is a little disingenuous, or I think it's commendable, but it's a little naive because it took a whole village of historically partners who didn't work together, community-based organizations who didn't trust labor who didn't trust minority contractors that were still waiting for the city to step up. I love the new numbers on the Portland building. I think you have great staff focused on it, but you're leaving out this collective community table Forget about the signatory. Although when you sign something, you're on the line for it, and all the members of the Community Oversight Committee were on the line. It was never going to be if we failed, the city didn't do something. It would have been the trades didn't step up, the community didn't step up. It was a collective. We never had that problem, mostly because of sunlight, but also because of shared agreement that was canonized by putting our organization's names on the line.
So that to me is an important, a very important question, issue, and it's about trust. It's about accountability. And how ultimately, I think we all agree, we'll be judged on the numbers. So we're talking about means and not ends. And I also just want to make one point. The underlying resolution, and I'm not here to, I'm going to respond to this because my bureau ran the pilot and because I have a commitment to this work. I'm just one member of the council. I'm not the person that did the independent review of this. And the only substantive role I've had recently is to say we're going to raise the bar on Washington Park. And I thought at the end of the day that was the most important part of this conversation was raising the bar for participation. And I also thought, because the city is often accused of not following through on promises, being accountable, I thought having the leadership of the city be accountable to that was actually a step forward. We have a disagreement about that because you have a trust issue, and I get that. And history is a guide, although I don't think the utilities have been the greatest offenders, but in fairness. But let's be clear. I mean, I just don't want the rhetoric to get in the way of the record and the relationship. Because you would almost think if you'd parachuted in here from another planet, that we actually had a fundamental disagreement about ends, and that we had some deeply principled divide about how to get there. There are some nuances, and I listened very carefully to your testimony. And frankly, to the one umbrage I would take is the idea that we've marginalized you by having you come together. It was my view that having this oversight committee come and take as much time as they need to present to council was honoring your work, not marginalizing it. But I have a sense that a number of things have been flipped upside down. We don't disagree about ends. We've set a higher bar going forward, and now we're talking about whether there are signatures. And I just want to be clear. And if it comes down to a question of signatures, I don't have the final say on this. We've adopted a CBP. My colleagues are all going to have views on that. I think you make a point, and I think we should engage that point. But I would just caution us not to say that the absence of a signature represents retreat from a commitment. And maybe enough damage has been done somehow, even though I have been told that the results were pretty good on the CBA, so I'm not quite sure how to reconcile that. But I don't want to leave a misimpression here about shared values. And I don't want you to think that the city has spent 4 years undermining this cause, because it's just not true. And if you have specific examples, because we've talked in the abstract, we've stayed away from identifying people, if you have specific examples, I want them. It doesn't have to be in this form. I want specific examples of any city staff that has subverted your work. And going forward, let's be clear, other than the community benefits plan where we raise the bar, this council has taken no further action on CBAs and the future of CBAs. And as the mayor said, the purpose of today's hearing is to hear from all of our friends, and there are some disagreements in the community. And then it is this mayor and the next mayor that have the authority to figure out where we go on that. But I just, when I heard throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I thought at some point we took a wrong turn here. And I just go back to, the 1% is inviolate, the bar has been raised, and the dispute is about a signatory. And that may warrant this level of conflict, but it does not, in my view, in any respect, represent a breach of agreement on the underlying goals.
Can I speak to that? I made that statement about the baby and the bathwater. I would say the baby is the means. The baby is the process, and that's how you build trust, and that's how you really make inroads in equity. These are hard issues that take a lot of partners working together. And the sense right now is, yes, let's all set that bar higher. Let's set those goals higher. Let's achieve better numbers. But let's not forget how we achieved the CBA numbers in the first place. And it really takes that community and turning inward and doing it internally without that real meaningful input and expertise from the community and labor seems like a misstep, in my opinion. That's where that comment came from.
Okay, thank you. Other responses?
I mean, just so two things. First is, I think originally my rebuttal, as you called it, was meant to be after hearing the presentation from your evaluator. So to that end, I do have copies of sort of our responses to the initial evaluation and that I'd like to provide for all of you and have entered into the record. Secondly, one small example that I will use that I feel was a way of undermining the big success with the beginning of a small potential problem was I had an opportunity, I think 2 years ago, to visit Commissioner Saltzman's office, and I apologize he's not here, so and to talk about the success of the CBA, which he was really interested in, or he gave us time to at least have the conversation. And his first question, or seemingly the question that was most interesting to him, was, why are you spending $4,300 supporting the cost of meeting participation of CBOs, or why did you spend that? So again, this is over a $100 million project, and I was like, so you've seen our draft report or an update, so you see the numbers, you see the good things, and you're asking me about a $4,300 worth of meeting attendance payments that the city asked CAUSE to develop an MOU because the city and the prime contractor recognize that the only ones not being compensated for their time, their travel, their mileage, their expertise were the community-based partners participating in the planning process. So city staff asked us to do that. We did that. We documented their attendance because the city gave us the attendance rosters, and that was the first question, not how are you guys beating historical city numbers. It was, where is this $4,300 going to? So to me, someone told him, they didn't own the fact that the city asked us to develop that process and procedures. Someone told them there was a questionable expense.
Okay, so can I just spell one last thing? Because we're getting to a point now where we're attributing motives and we're talking
about... Well, no, but you asked for an example. I just want to give you an example.
But it's very hard to shadow box without specifics, and we're making assumptions. And I will say, as the commissioner in charge of the utilities, for the record, that I am grateful for the service of the LMCOC. I am grateful for the work that you did. The findings of the independent pilot evaluation are findings of an independent evaluator, which we are free to accept, reject, or accept in part or reject, or whatever we want. But it was prescribed by the underlying resolution. It's an independent evaluator's findings. You disagree with many of the findings. That's your freedom. That's the purpose of this hearing. But perhaps we should have started, and it's my fault, and I should have started by saying thank you for your service. And it sounds like we haven't had enough occasions to say that, and we haven't had enough occasions to celebrate the progress, and we haven't had enough face-to-face conversations to talk about our shared goals. That's my takeaway from this conversation. But I also want you to know, because Mayor said at the beginning, and I want to make sure we're all clear on this, we're not going from this hearing to sausage making. This is a hearing to hear from the public on the matters before us. And I guess if anything, while I think I disagree actually pretty strongly with a couple of things that were said, I appreciate that we have the relationship where you in a forum like this are so candid with the council about your views on this matter. And I have no doubt that we have shared values driving this thing. There may be some differences about means, but at the end of the day, I actually will tell you that I'm much more interested in outcomes these days, because we end up spending a lot of time, in my opinion, fighting over the wrong stuff. I'm interested in outcomes. And in the CVP for the Washington Park, the city has said we are accountable for those outcomes. And you're going to hold us accountable whether you're a signatory or not. I know that. So thank you.
Thank you all very much. So let's
we have one more. We have another panel. No, we don't. We have Linda Lewis is from Framework LLC, is going to present the CBA evaluation report.
Okay. Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you,
Mayor.
Linda, I apologize. We probably should have had you first and then some commentary to follow, but welcome.
That's okay.
Carla will assist if needed with our complicated PowerPoint procedure here. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, my name is Linda Lewis. I'm the principal of Framework LLC, which is a single-member limited liability company that's based in Ridgefield, Washington. And I happen to be a WBE, a woman-owned business, both in Washington and Oregon State. And I was retained to do an independent evaluation of the CBA. And so I want to share with you my findings. Again, these are my findings. These are not the city's findings. This is an independent evaluation. And I'll speak to some of the things that John raised in the last presentation. Before I get started, I guess, though, there are a lot of people in this room that I had the pleasure to speak with as a part of my evaluation, including John Gardner and some of the members of the last panel, and I just want to say that I thank them immensely for their cooperation, for their being willing to take time with me to collect information to help me out. So I was very pleased to work with these individuals. I want to share with you the evaluation findings, but I want to tell you a little bit about the evaluation approach first. Very quickly, there were four components of this evaluation. First was a financial analysis of the 1% set-aside funds. What we were looking at was where and how were funds were authorized, how they were dispersed, who received them, what they were used for. Second, we did a program and process analysis. And I should say, when I speak to we, I subcontracted with Paul Lewis, who happens to be my husband, but he did the financial analysis and worked with me on this engagement. We did a program and process analysis looking at program outcomes and objectives. Were they clearly identified? Were they well understood? We looked at contractual relationships between the various entities. We looked at the way funds were awarded, and we also looked at monitoring activities. Third, we conducted a performance analysis. We looked at whether or not the CBA achieved its goals and objectives. We compared the two pilot projects. The two pilot Water Bureau projects, and we looked at the effectiveness of various strategies that were funded by the 1% money. And finally, we did a comparative analysis. We compared the pilot projects with similar city projects, and we also looked at the way that funds were awarded, comparing them with other city programs that also grant funds. So based on the four components, I want to share with you some of the things that we found very quickly. Well, I should mention, too, that this was a pretty comprehensive evaluation in a very short amount of time. We interviewed 17 representatives from the different entities that are represented here. We reviewed lots of documents and lots of data, including LMCOC minutes and various artifacts of the project over the last 4 years. And we conducted an on-site review at the WSI, of the WSI and cause records, since they were acting as a fund administrator, that joint entity, and I'll speak to that in a minute. I want to say that what we did, though, was a review and not an audit. So we were attempting to do an evaluation, but not an audit of the funds or any of the procedures that occurred. So briefly, findings. As you've already heard from other testimony today, in terms of performance against goals, the pilot projects were very successful in meeting most CBA goals. As you've noted, and I'll show you in a minute, all of the projects, pilot and non-pilot, struggled to meet goals for journey-level hours worked by women. But I would like to talk a little bit about a point that's been made and critiqued by earlier testimony. Comparable projects also achieved good results against these goals, and I want to take just a minute to look at those. So we were given four comparable projects that were similar in size and scope to the two pilot projects and that were using alternative procurement methods. And what we did was we contacted the contractors, we looked at data, and we looked at performance. And what we learned was the CBA performed very well against CBA goals, but some of the other contractors did as well. And in the area of utilization of minorities, you can see the performance on this graphic. The goal was 18% in the CBA. All of the comparable organizations except for Mount Tabor met or exceeded that. Quickly looking at the utilization for women, everybody struggled with the 9% of journey worker hours being dedicated to women, but everybody except Mount Tabor, all the projects except Mount Tabor, were successful in exceeding the apprentice work hour goals for women. And then I flipped this chart on its side. It's sideways in the report, and John Gardner pointed this out. It's a little bit easier to see it this way, although the lines are a bit faint. This is the performance of comparable projects against CBA contracting diversity goals. And what this shows is that Interstate and Kelly Butte were very successful in meeting diversity goals. In other words, in terms of the percent of hard construction costs that went to minority, women, disadvantaged business, and emerging small business firms. All of the projects, though, were reasonably successful, and all of the projects struggled a little bit, except for Interstate, Southwest Moody, and Kelly Butte, meeting the 22% diversity goal. Meeting the yes, the 12% goal. So I share these with you not to say that the CBA wasn't necessary, because that's not what we're attempting to represent here. Excuse me. What we're representing is, and our evaluation wasn't comprehensive enough to know all of the reasons why the pilot was successful and the other firms were also successful, other projects were also successful in meeting goals. I share this only because other projects did achieve goals and would have achieved the CBA goals. And as John pointed out in the last panel, there are likely reasons for success. And I think these are important because they're reasons that the CBA was successful, but they're also perhaps reasons that the other projects were successful, and they do need to be taken account of as the city moves forward in whatever solution it chooses. First and foremost, well-understood goals for workforce and contracting diversity, including both apprentice and journey-level goals. The CBA had very well spelled out goals in this area. Some of the other projects had goals spelled out as well. Not all of them were as refined, and not all of them used a breakdown of apprentice and journey-level. But goals were there, and what we were told in our interviews is that if contractors are given goals, they will do everything that they can to achieve them. Accountability is extremely important, including active compliance monitoring, which you saw in the CBA, and you also saw in some of the other projects, or you would see, we saw. Participation of key stakeholders, hugely important, and stakeholders including labor organizations, participation in real-time project workforce support and program design. This is where the CBA really excelled, but what we saw in other projects was that stakeholders were also involved, not to the extent as they were in the CBA, and we do believe that key stakeholder involvement is critical to the success of any endeavor going forward. Contractor commitment to the city's diversity goals, capabilities to support them, and willingness to participate. Huge. If contractors are committed, then projects will be successful. And finally, investments in outreach, training, and technical assistance to minorities, women, disadvantaged, and emerging small business firms. And what we found in our evaluation was that a lot of this outreach, training, and technical assistance occurred on the non-CBA projects. So that may have contributed to the success of some of the non-CBA projects. Again, our role wasn't to prove what reasons for why things worked and why they didn't on all projects, but these are the likely reasons that we ascertained from our work and from what the literature told us. We also looked at the 1% program performance. And the 1% programs, again, are those funds, the three funds that were funded by 1% of the construction money that was set aside for that purpose. What we learned was that the programs did indeed achieve positive results, but not specifically for the pilot projects. You've heard before that few participants were actually employed on a pilot project, and that is true. There are some reasons for that. Pre-apprenticeship training programs were funded after the construction contracts were set, and as such, they had limited ability to plan for project needs. Had that pipeline been up and running earlier, they might have been able to get more of those participants onto projects. That's not to say they didn't do good work, because they did. They trained a whole lot of people, and they were very successful in what they did. Just those participants didn't end up on the pilot project. Technical assistant program, the design and the development and the procurement of getting that program kind of up and running from scratch, that took a lot of time, took a lot of resources. And so by the time the program was up and running, there were opportunities to help firms, good opportunities, good work was done, but not a lot of firms were employed on the pilot projects. What our conclusion was as a result of this evaluation was that the 1% programs are most likely to provide longer-term community benefits, and by that I mean community benefits for many projects, not just for the pilot projects. So we're not saying that they weren't a success or that they failed. We're saying that those benefits are yet to be observed. We took a long look at CBA structure and governance, and some of the findings I need to explain to you because I've heard them taken out of context. We found that the LMCOC was a very important organization, had a very important role on this project and on the pilot projects, but it did have too many responsibilities for basically a volunteer organization with no legal identity and no formal staff. So the CBA created this organization, but gave it no legal authority, which caused some problems, and I'll go into that in a moment. So you've heard talk of conflict of interest, and what we've said in the report is that governance created potential for conflict of interest. We never observed any conflict of interest. We did observe, however, that a very small number of individuals designed programs and awarded contracts and were fund recipients, but that was sort of the nature of the beast. A small number of core people did a whole lot of work on this project to make it successful, but the way that the CBA was structured gave some appearance of conflict of interest. Now, as you've heard in earlier testimony, folks were very sensitive to this. They were aware of it. They discussed it in their meetings. They said that they recused themselves from procurement processes, and we agree all that that was true. We did not find conflict of interest. But what we didn't find was signed conflict of interest statements, even though we asked for them several times. They may have been there. They just didn't migrate it their way to our project. And so going forward, we believe that that's an important thing to do for any governance structure that gets adopted. I mentioned the relationships between a small number of people. Another relationship that complicated fund administration was the basic contractual relationship among all these groups. So the CBA document gave the LMCOC authority for fund oversight and management. But the LMCOC, again, had no legal ability to spend or receive funds. They're a volunteer organization, but they had no legal ability. They're given all of these responsibilities, and they're given all this authority, but they don't have really any ability to do anything with it. The CBA also identified WSI cause as fund recipients. But unfortunately, there was no real contract or agreement with the LMCOC, because again, there was no legal ability to do that, to perform the role. So over time, the parties adopted some ways to pass the money through, which weren't ideal, but they did what they had to do given the nature of the beast. And they passed the 1% funds from the city to Hoffman through a contract and then on to cause using a purchase order. I won't belabor this too much, but just understand that the city had a contract with Hoffman to do the construction work. The money, the 1% money went to Hoffman, who in turn used a purchase order to get the money to cause, who used an existing contract with Work Systems to get the money there so that the work could continue. I raise this only because it's not ideal. It's something that we would say, if you're going to do this in the future, don't do it this way. And that's the only reason we raise it in the report. As John mentioned earlier, we found that WSI, who was acting as the fund administrator for the CBA, used very good practices for procurement, invoice review, and payment authorization. We had a chance to look at their records. Again, not an audit, but we wanted to see how things were transpiring, and we found good practices being used. Much has been made about the comment in the report about provider contracts not being performance-based. We didn't raise this to be critical necessarily because they weren't required to be performance-based. Many jurisdictions do have that requirement. City of Portland doesn't necessarily. But in terms of good practice, it's always good to find opportunities where you can pay for actual contractor performance. And by that, I don't mean just delivery of widgets. I mean achieving desirable outcomes. Most of the contracts, by definition for the outreach and training programs, for example, are cost reimbursement contracts, and that's pretty traditional for that type of contract. But what we would recommend going forward is looking for ways to make things more performance-based. And then there's the issue of administrative costs. We do believe that they were high relative to some city programs, and our experience has been that 14 to 15 or 16% is probably more in line. The 17% number, though, does include startup costs, and so it makes it a little bit difficult to do a comparison. So there was a lot of startup involved in the CBA program, which added to these administrative costs. So moving forward, again, we were hired as independent evaluators. We weren't hired to do a design for a revised CBA or to throw out the CBA and come up with something net new. But we did identify some recommendations that we believe are important going forward or opportunities and to use in whatever the city elects to build for a community benefits instrument. In terms of government, we believe it's really important to organizationally separate project-related activities. Those are things like utilization, placement of employees, technical assistance, from fund administration, the things like accounting, procurement, contracting. Those got commingled to some degree on this project, and they really need to be separated. It's important to define manageable committee roles and responsibilities. So if you're using committees going forward, and if you're using something like an LMCOC, then you need to clearly define what it is they're charged with doing and make sure what it is they're charged with doing is doable under their charter and provide adequate staff support. For fund administration, it's important to have any and all contracts in place before work begins and not try to do that after the fact. We do believe it's also important to require signed conflict of interest statements. If it was done on this project, great. We didn't see evidence of it. It needs to be done going forward. It's also important to include project closeout procedures and think about researching and considering performance-based contracting. Oversight is incredibly important, as you've heard in previous testimony. We would add to the oversight. We would advocate for program and financial audit provisions, kind of above and beyond what individual programs get audited by virtue of their funding. We'd also advocate for improved and expanded program evaluation and performance monitoring. And earlier testimony talked about some of the things that are in the works for disaggregating data even further and looking at participation of minorities and women in terms of ethnicity and some of the other details that would give you more information to work with. In terms of the programs, we'd recommend that you use the 1% program funding to create a pipeline of qualified, diverse individuals and firms for multiple city projects, not just one project at a time. We recommend that you provide ample lead time to organizations who are trying to build your pipeline prior to starting a contract, and we would hope that the contracts would get cut after the agreements are reached and not before. And it's important to differentiate the kind of technical assistance that the CBA or other 1% set-aside programs could provide. Differentiate that from that which is typically provided by contractors. Because what we learned in our comparative analysis is that contractors do indeed provide technical assistance. It is different than what you saw in the CBA pilot, but you need to make sure that those are differentiated so that there's a value add there. And with that, I'll turn it over to you for questions.
Questions. Linda, thank you very much.
I'll just make one comment about conflicts of interest and training. So I've taken a deeper dive on that, and I plan to bring some stuff to council later this fall. The reality is, the city guidelines on those disclosures are anything but clear, and they are, in fact, treated as if they are voluntary and not mandatory. And there is, in my judgment, inadequate training that accompanies that, particularly in areas where people de facto become public officials in performing a function. And I think one of my takeaways from this, independent of your report, is that the city has to create some clearer guidelines and expectations in terms of whatever you have to fill out, what do you have to disclose, and then providing training. Because it seems to me a number of the things that you identify in this really come back to us in terms of not providing clarity and the necessary training for people to perform the function we're asking. And these are actually citizen volunteers, so I think that's an important point.
Right.
So another point I just want to raise and get you to respond to, and that is if you listen to this discussion and this debate here today and otherwise over the last few weeks and months, you raised the importance of participation of key stakeholders. Aside from the substance of what's been accomplished in these pilot projects and the goals that we have set and are setting, and aside from the substance of what works, quite a bit of agreement about that, there's a big divide here about how much power will reside in community-based oversight versus the bureaucracy. We heard that very clearly in the previous presentation. Respond to that. I mean, that's the big... That's the big item in the room here, I think, or one of them anyway.
Right.
Which is how much, it's our responsibility as elected officials to change the culture and practices of the city in ways that make the city work better, and also ways that make it work better for people outside of the bureaucracy. We're all public servants here. And so it's our job to sometimes require and direct our employees to do things that are uncomfortable and different. And like any big organization, we get resistance to that. So a big part of the point that we've heard so far in this discussion and otherwise is you won't get that change unless there's real power in an oversight function. Tell me what you think about that.
Well, and I by that I think you're implying that it has to be an oversight function of community-based organizations.
Right, oversight of us.
Yeah.
Speaking collectively of the us here.
Yeah, what we found is that oversight is incredibly important and community participation is incredibly important. Now, how you mix those two things is sort of the difficult decision that you have to make.
Okay.
I would hate to see going forward that the community-based organization piece of it got left behind in the move forward. Whether or not that means, though, they have to have the same level of oversight that they have right now, I don't know that I'm equipped to speak to that. But I do believe that the community-based organization involvement is huge, because that's been suggested both in the work that we've done and in work that other jurisdictions have done in looking at this issue.
Very helpful. Thank you. Other questions? Linda. Thank you very much. Appreciate your report, both here and front of us and here in this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mayor, we have some invited guests.
Okay.
And we'll just take them in order. Groups of four. Nate McCoy from NAMCO, Pat Daniels from Constructing Hope, Keith Edwards, retired IBEW, now on the board of Constructing Hope, and James Fashion.
Please come on up. Or others on their behalf. Thank you.
Nate, why don't you start?
Right. Thank you for having me today, Mayor, Commissioners. Pleased to be here. This is definitely a lively discussion. As you mentioned, I am the NAMAC ED.
The whole thing slides down if you want.
Big box will slide if you aren't using
that. I want you to be comfortable.
Okay. All right. So, again, NAMAC, National Association of Minority Contractors, Organs Chapter. Again, I represent a national organization, not just a local organization. We have a membership of 33 minority-owned businesses, 28 public agency partners, including prime contractors of various scales that work on City Portland projects. And really what NAMAC's mission and really its legacy is all about is building bridges and crossing barriers. So really what I'm going to be talking about today is really about the barriers that our contractors face. Obviously, workforce is a huge shortage in our community across the board. There's numerous reports that say that there's a lot of work to still be done. The conversations that I'm in, it seems like somewhat sometimes we're undermined and not really at the table. Some of the reports that we've heard from today, I see logos of our affiliates that aren't really connected to these conversations. There's email exchanges that come and go, but really not bringing the conversations together. Our mission is really about creating contractors that work on City Portland projects. And what I know by from numbers and experience is that our contractors are not being put to work on City of Portland projects. And it's not a strange phenomenon that minority contractors generally hire minority workforce. And if you looked across the board at most of our contractors we represent, nobody's really stretching far enough, I guess, to really identify the issues around our engagement. You know, we hear a lot of stories from our membership about CBA projects, non-CBA projects, signatory agreements, as you spoke to, being barriers. We have contractors that are well off, that do very great work, that are union and non-union. But when we get to the point of bypassing where some of our contractors are and what their needs are, we're never going to get to a point of actually acknowledging where the gaps are in the industry. And as I spoke to last week, really what I want to make sure that we don't forget about in some of the discussion that's happened is, regardless if we're looking at a CBA or a community benefits plan, let's look at, as we heard from Linda who just spoke, let's look at the performance and the track record of these projects. We no longer want to talk about MWESB. We want to talk about minority, we want to talk about women, and we want to talk about ESB. And I think what happens is we lump the conversations together far too often, and until we get to a point of disaggregating, as she spoke to, the devil's in the details. So, I mean, I think what I really credit myself for doing when I was a housing commissioner once upon a time was really to listen to our community, listen to our contractors. I never had challenges on projects that I managed for the Housing Bureau, meeting the numbers, going out to the community stakeholders, partnering with NAMAC and MCIP at the time, and really disaggregating information so we told the real stories. The stories I hear is that there's a lot of discrimination. There's a lot of lack of trust, and we've heard that theme tonight. There's a lot of nuances and things that I think, you know, we try to put everybody in the same box. And I don't think people are at the same scale of company-wise. We have technical assistance providers. They're not tapped enough on these projects to help support it. I actually commend the statement about a 1% across the board. We're not looking at just one project. We have workforce training, apprenticeship programs in the room. Very, very great organizations should be doing the work they're doing, but a lot of them are passing off their pre-apprentices to union or non-union shops, and I think that's where sometimes things can get a little dicey. And really, really what I'm up here today to really discuss with you guys is let's look at the positive things that we're doing. I mentioned last week we have two parks projects where we actually have prime contractors of color working on them. Housing Bureau projects, prime contractors of color working on them. Not subcontractors, prime contractors. We're out here in the school systems, and in my NAMAC newsletters that are in the DJC, I'm sure you've read them, we're out here talking to the Portland Public Schools with kids. We're not getting paid to do this. We're not making, you know, any kind of commitments that feel dicey or that kids can't actually tangibly see as a career pathway. We're really trying to build the relationships. And I think sometimes some of these workforce efforts seem like a production cycle, almost like we're just trying to get in and meet the numbers without really trying to sit kids down at some point in time and say, look, there's this contractor who actually is an electrician that looks like you that might want to take you out, show you some job sites. We do this stuff all the time, but nobody talks about it. Nobody brings us in to say, how do we utilize and tap into what you're doing to enhance our programs? So I think those are core things that have to happen. One of the things that I wanted to say also along the lines is there's just so much tremendous undue burden on the contractors that we're trying to work with, compliance requirements. You're talking about contractors that might have 4 or 5 employees, some more, but some less, and would love to work on city projects. But who is sitting these contractors down besides Nate McCoy and saying, how do we meet you at where you are and be an incubator for your business so that we can utilize you on projects? Now, I've come up with a couple of recommendations, and I really am open that we can have a dialogue of some sort because I'm sure some questions will come up. But there's a couple key things just real quickly wearing my prior hat as a construction manager that I saw being a city employee and really being invested in equity during the duration of my tenure was we need to make sure that we actually have a tangible conversation about CMGCs versus low bid processes. I've never had anybody really talk about that. I don't hear any other groups talking about how the movement and traction of growing businesses is so impactful if we really take a hard look at other alternative contracting methods.
I did hear Fred in his opening comments say that what one thing we have learned is that if we move away from low bid and look at alternative contracting, that's where the action happens. So is that, I mean, that's...
Absolutely.
And obviously, on some of the alternative contracting, we're bound by state law, and there's requirements. But I think Fred was pretty clear, I think, in his opening comments, that we agree with that proposition, that moving away from low bid actually gives us more opportunity to get to our goals.
Absolutely, and I would agree. But I think what gets confusing in the process is that sometimes community stakeholders aren't a part of those conversations. So I can't tell you how a CMGC is put together or the process steps in place to justify it or not. It seems like if there was a little bit of a community engagement in that process, maybe we might, as partners and advocates of contractors, be able to work side by side with the city to figure out what kind of projects make sense, what size of projects look good, how can we really support contractors who really want to engage and really market these projects to these contractors, not the other way around. Because I feel like sometimes contractors or city government would like you to fit into a nice, pretty box, and we need to step back and really see how we can actually dissect that and really do something more proactive and more actually in an engagement role. So that's one thing. And I'm talking about $10 million and below type size projects, which, again, are parks projects. The second is the threshold of workforce training and hiring. And I know there probably won't be a fondness in the room for this statement, but being a city manager and working with housing developers and contractors, it's very challenging for a business with a $100,000 threshold to really, at that size, really manage the compliance, reporting, and documentation that it takes to keep up with the workforce training and hiring programs and processes. And I really, for the last 8-10 years, have been wondering, well, what kind of impact in the workforce are we making with businesses that small or contract sizes that small? Is that one apprentice? Is that two apprentices? Most times that's all it is. So why not limit that threshold a little higher, or put the threshold a little higher, closer to 400,000, where we know maybe some contractors won't drown in the paperwork, won't be penalized for not meeting maybe some of these workforce goals? Because most contractors doing maybe 400,000 plus might have a little bit more systems in place where they can actually support the workforce needs and be able to appropriately run their shops in a way where they can respond to those compliances.
Nate, we have a lot of people that signed up, so I'm going to ask you to give us one more.
Yep.
And then I'm going to
yep.
ask you, if you would, to follow up in writing with these recommendations.
Absolutely.
And we will continue this conversation. I'm afraid I want to also make sure between now and dinner that we hear from everybody, just get a complete record.
Correct.
But thank you for also being very precise in your recommendations.
Absolutely. And so lastly, and not to say the least, you guys already have a program that's thriving right now, Prime Contractor Development Program, led by Stacey Edwards. I mean, I don't hear enough acknowledgement of the great work she's doing. She is a rock star for a lot of the members that we support and has really been an ally and advocate. Christine Moody made the greatest hire I think she could have made in hiring her, because she is really running feverishly through city agencies and some of our bureaus that do procurement to really dial in on projects that make sense for some of the members that we support and the members that are generally, you know, not associated with NAMAC. And I think where we need to take it is, what you'll hear is that some of these dollar projects are too small for some of the ones that are a little bigger. So I want to recommend that we look at maybe another tier bracket between 1 and 4 million, somewhere in that range, where some contractors who aren't interested in bidding on 500,000 and below projects or have outgrown that size should have something that works for them. And we're not talking about sourcing projects to anybody. We're talking about that group that she supports, over 40 contractors bidding against one another on bigger projects. And I think that's the thing that would help support like real growth, real capacity building. And with that said, I will shut up and let others speak, since we have a big agenda. But certainly it's important for us to recognize some of these things we can do now and not in the future.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Pat, welcome.
Good afternoon, Commissioners and Mayor Hills. My name is Pat Daniels, and I'm the Executive Director for Constructing Hope. And I'm basically here to just give context to the people who benefited from the Community Benefits Agreement. The mission of Constructing Hope, we're in the business of rebuilding the lives of people in our community through encouraging self-sufficiency through skill training and education in the construction trades. We target people who are low income, we target people coming from incarceration, and we target just our community. So with that being said, our role here was to provide certified, trained minorities and women for the CBA project and create a pathway for them to enter construction. So I believe that we did that through the Community Benefits Agreement, which we've talked about. And a little bit later, you'll hear from Isis Harris and Melina Weisner, who are two women who benefited from this project. I think the CBA was a great tool that helped us accomplish that mission of opening the doors for people of color and women to enter the trades. And just to give you a little bit of context, we're one of the programs that received the largest amount of funding from that project. Prior to receiving those funds, we were running classes of 16 people per year, 16 people per class 3 times a year. Those funds helped us increase our numbers, which I want to go back and just say the diversity study that the city had showed a true absence of African-American men in the trades. Through that project, we increased our numbers, inserting 62% of our numbers increased by 62% with African-Americans on that project. And so it was due to the support from the city on those funds. That also increased our training by 25%. It allowed Constructing Hope to increase our numbers from 16 people per class to 25. So again, that was a great pathway for these folks. Our number of folks just going into apprenticeship, as we said, not everybody was going to be on those projects. We were already behind. But what we did was we increased our numbers of people entering apprenticeship by 30%. So I just want to say that we appreciated the process, and bringing the community and labor in good faith to the table. I have heard that there was, you know, some distinguish of separating union and non-union, but I want to say that Constructing Hope has relationship with both union and non-union. We work very closely with the unions, and we have direct entry with Northwest College of Construction for a non-union apprenticeship. So I just want to thank you for allowing us to come today, and we would just like to say that there was a lot in the report that is not showing all of the lessons learned, and we appreciate it if you did not accept the report as written.
Thank you.
Don't leave now.
Go ahead, Keith.
Thought you were going to validate my parking ticket. Good afternoon, Mayor. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Thank you for allowing us to be here to give you some information today. I just want to give you a little bit more about my background. I started, I've been in the Portland community since 1958. I've started my apprenticeship in 1969 in the IBEW. I'm a union electrician. And in those 45 years that I was a union electrician, I've seen a lot of water under the bridge. And I've been recruiting for all those years, trying to bring about change in our industry as well as the building trades in general, and making sure that we had some diversity and inclusion. It's been a challenge, but at the same time, I think there has been some good times and there has been some successes. I am on the board at Constructing Hope, and I heard some testimony earlier about conflicts of interest. That's the reason I didn't want Commissioner Fish to leave, because I may have a conflict of interest simply because Constructing Hope does work on prison-to-work pipeline for African-Americans and others in our community. But I think everyone in this room, everybody in the state of Oregon, should have a conflict of interest or self-interest in that respect, simply because 1.8% of the population in this state is African-American, whereas 9% of our prison population is African-American. So that puts it on everybody's plate. So with that, I'd like to say also that the CBA has worked. It's been very successful. It has certainly a better track record than the city has in regards to diversity and inclusion. There's nuances that probably need to be added to it. It's not perfect, and it can be changed, and it can be made better, that's for sure. Also wanted to say, too, that I do, being on the board of Constructing Hope, Pat Daniels asked me one time about bringing someone from the non-union electrical apprenticeship program, the training director, on board to our board. And I said, certainly, I don't have a problem with that. I have a real problem with telling the participants in our program that they only have one option, and that's to be union. Because I'd look real crazy when they can't get into a union program, they have to wait 6 months or a year to reapply. They need to go to work, and they need to have those opportunities available to them. Also, I know people that are members of NAMCO as well. And when I was involved in the process of developing the community benefits agreement with MAWE, I personally invited members of NAMCO to get involved and to participate. And also just want to say that I think that going forward, I think that there are some great opportunities here, but the CBA has clearly shown that aggressive goals can be met. And those goals could be more aggressive. But I think that the City Council is not prepared with the information that you have available to you here and with the report to make a decision, given that the report is, I think, flawed in a sense because of the information that's been put in that report. It's a little bit biased, and I believe that it should have been a report that is certainly objective. Just wanted to share again that with my background and my experience, and I wanted Commissioner Fish to hear this, that he's never spoken with me. And I challenge any, there's no one in this room that has more construction experience than I have. I've been in the industry since 1969. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you very much. Welcome. There's a button on the bottom of that microphone. Just please push that. Everybody will be able to hear you. There you go.
Good afternoon. My name is James Faison. My company is Faison Construction. I just want to clarify, Faison. we We are a small contracting company, and I just want to speak a little bit about the CBA. We know that if it wasn't for the CBA, we wouldn't have gotten the big projects that we are on. Our goal is to employ people and to give kids a chance. We stand on a street corner on Martin Luther King and Ainsworth every Sunday from 2 to 4, just passing out flyers and talking to kids. Just a group of minority contractors just trying to get kids to know that they have alternatives. And we're pretty proud of that, and it's successful. If we can get one kid a week, we're happy. But going back to the CBA, it has worked for my company, and it's helped me to get